His name is Mark. Mr. Mark Beatty. He is the principal of the Hickey Associates LLC from Charlotte, North Carolina. And we are very pleased to have him. He is going to talk with our committee about Minnesota's competitiveness in the global economy. And so, Mr. Beatty, if you'd like to come to the witness table and introduce yourself by starting with your name for the record. The hearing will be taped, and so if there's an exchange, I'll be commenting who's speaking. So just for the record, we'll be taking some good notes on the exchanges. And members, we have a short hearing today. We're hoping to let Mr. Beatty provide the full presentation, and then if there's time after that, we'll take some questions. And he also will make himself available to us after the hearing for questions or answers by email or via mail. So he's available. But today we're going to try and get through his presentation, let him tell us what we need to know about Minnesota's competitiveness in the global economy. And it is a pleasure to have you here, sir. Thank you so much for joining us.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good morning, and thank you for this opportunity to address the committee on the subject of global competitiveness, company's perspective on site selection and critical decision factors. My name is Mark Beatty. I'm a principal with Hickey & Associates. We are a global site selection and incentives consulting firm based and founded in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I happen to live in Charlotte as one of the branch offices. But I did live in Minnesota for 12 years, and it's nice to be back here in January. My background, I have 35 years in corporate real estate and facilities. I worked on hundreds of strategic and tactical real estate and site selection projects that branch global regions. And also a lot of assessments of existing operations. So in this talk, I will be talking about not only new locations and sightings, but also the proposition that companies continuously look at their current portfolio and the validation of those operations going forward. It's working. Correct plan. Sorry. It's right here. A little bit about H&A, our background. We have represented a wide range of diverse industries, and we have a select list of clients, some of which I'm sure you're very familiar with and recognize on this. But it's important to note that this gives a very wide range perspective on where companies are in a number of industries. Today's focus will be on these five key areas. Just to set the stage, today's business environment, global competition and what is at stake, company-specific location decisions, looking at the financial impact in particular with an emphasis on taxes, and Minnesota's competitive profile. Taking a moment to just look at setting the stage for the challenging global economy. There really are longer sales cycles, and it's been a very cautionary period, at least over the last 2 to 3 years. This really sets the tone for understanding how companies have had to adjust based on this global economy. Market dynamics are very mixed. There are some industries that are doing very well despite the difficult economic times, and then there are others that have struggled mightily. Risk adverse and fundamentals essential. In order to survive and get through this, companies have had to look very closely at and address risk as a key component to how they assess their business. And fundamentals are essential in understanding what makes them competitive and what allows them to survive. Capital markets concerns have been a major issue, as everyone knows, and very conservative in view of how that capital can be obtained and how it's going to be used. It's clear, for instance, 5 years ago, if you were to look at, for instance, two of the darlings in Europe, being Ireland and Portugal, they were considered this magnificent rolling economy and the leaders of the new wave. And in fact, today they're struggling to survive. They are the chain, if you will, around the neck of the EU in particular. Cash, and we're going to talk a lot about cash, is very critical. The prioritization of cash during this period has been extremely extreme focus for companies as well as government. Redeployment of capital only to value add is the critical factor for companies going forward. They cannot spend at a degree or to a level that they had in the past, so they have to prioritize. Increased levels of corporate due diligence and risk mitigation, and you'll hear me repeatedly talk about risk. Companies are constantly viewing the upside and downside of every decision. And so risk mitigation and being able to eliminate risk is critical for them. Although slower growth over this period, companies and, as I should add, economic development concerns with government are ready to grab opportunity and looking for those opportunities that make sense. And they support alternative solutions or looking for flexibility and creativity in ways to bridge their operations going forward. Looking through that period, companies really looked at it from a strategic standpoint and then a tactical. The strategic planning process basically managed strategies in turbulent times, looking at uncertain conditions, particularly 2008 through 2010. So in that, they emphasized on portfolio optimization, really protecting those key businesses and nurturing those and looking at those as what they needed to focus on. They prioritize resource allocation, which is a nice way of saying trimmed workforce, cut back where they could, reduce and consolidate, and through that consolidation. So that was all the playing that went on between 2008 and 2010. And they looked at scenario modeling for the duration. Is it going to improve in 2009, 2010, 2011? So a lot of the focus was being very conservative and holding back through this period and seeing where and what indices would indicate there's improvement on the way. 2011 suggests that there's tactical implementation and preparedness for an improved economy. So increased optimism based on fundamentals and market indices are clearly indicated in Q4 2010, albeit not great. Nevertheless, it does show some signs of improvement. Companies have built up reserves through the earlier slide about optimization or the earlier point about optimization and prioritized resource allocation, meaning that while they maintained a certain level of profitability, they didn't go out and spend clearly. What they did was contain their capital and preparedness for the improved economy and improved opportunities. And strengthen recovery and sustained growth. While they look to do that, they also want to manage the risk associated with that. So they're not going to just jump out and address opportunities with respect to the recovery without going through a very rigorous pattern of assessment. Looking at setting the stage for global economy recovery and the competition, global competition is increasing and it's fierce. And this is really a mainstay of where the world is today, anywhere and everywhere you go. And I bring this up because, in fact, any community, any state, any country who's not looking at it from a global perspective is missing the point. Your competition is 12,000 miles away, and your competition is 150 miles away. It's everywhere. Companies think globally and they act locally. So they're constantly looking at it in a micro and macro perspective. There are shorter cycles, so their business portfolios, the products and services they offer, don't have quite the shelf life they once had. So they're constantly looking at how and where they can refine that and understand that they constantly need to regenerate and reproduce meaningful products and services that are going to maintain their market share and their competitive advantage. Growth, both organic, which all companies look to nurture, in the near term suggests, and we've seen evidence, that M&As have been really the mainstay of where companies have been able to maintain top-line growth and market share. But they always and want to consistently look at organic growth in areas that make sense. And I will allude to the fact that in order to do that, they need to preserve capital, and they redeploy that capital in a conservative but very focused way. They do have capital waiting on the sidelines, but it's cautious optimism. Both financial services groups, banks, have worked through this program and are beginning to get back into a position where they're more comfortable in lending. So capital is more readily available. Corporations, through their optimization and conservative approach, have been able to establish some reserves, and in doing so, they're able to position themselves better for the opportunities that are looming around the corner. However, their increased level of corporate due diligence, and again, risk and return, is a constant. Every decision that's made, every investment that's made, goes through a very rigorous set of criteria in assessing risk. External partners and support alternative solutions, and I put that line in there because that also then suggests where they operate and how they operate is very important. So the partnership between government, the partnership between the communities they're in, and also their extended services, if you will, and partners in business, whether they're alliances or their JVs or whatever that may be, are critical for companies to succeed going forward. High assurance of proven success and competitiveness is essential. So when they go through an assessment process, there is a very rigorous set, and I'll get into site selection in particular, but a very rigorous set of criteria that need to be met before these companies are going to extend themselves. If you think for a moment about a manufacturing site, and let's say it's a proven, through piloting operations, a proven manufacturing operation, this company may be starting off with 100,000 square feet, $250 million in capital improvement, including building, land, and the line that goes in, probably hiring somewhere between 75 and 100 startup, growing to 250 employees. And this is significant capital. They're doing this not to be there for 2 or 3 years. They're doing it to be there 20, 30, 40, or 50 years. So you can imagine when you make those kinds of decisions in that capital deployment, you're going to want to be absolutely sure that the environment you're setting this in is competitive and has longevity, sustainability. What goes into companies' decisions as it relates to location decisions? Well, clearly business requirements, the location requirements, and then the cost of doing business is critical. The business requirements, above and beyond the obvious that this is going to improve our market share and increase our revenues, our fundamentals, land and building. Do they have the right type of infrastructure and land and buildings that we need in order to conduct this particular business? I chose in this particular modeling to focus on industrial manufacturing, but a lot of this criteria would apply across a wide band of businesses. Machinery and equipment and the investment in producing that, having it built, having it assembled, having it installed. Inventories, how inventories from raw materials into finished goods are going to be regulated, the financing of all of this and the environment for that, the annual sales revenue in relationship to these investments. The workforce, of course, is critical, raw materials, research and development, and particularly in manufacturing, companies like to have R&D, particularly in leading areas of technology or new business offerings, relatively close. And you will see for global concerns when they go outside the United States in major markets in major areas, they will reproduce and assemble R&D operations within those segments of the globe. You see that happening in Asia. It certainly happened in Europe back in the 50s and 60s. It's pretty much norm that follows suit. Obviously, utilities, electricity, natural gas, production, distribution, and technology are key. It then leads into location requirements. Supply chain is super critical for any of these businesses. If they cannot have a dedicated and continuous supply chain, all of the investment is for naught. Quality of workforce is super critical. I know that's been addressed repeatedly, but it has to be proven and it has to be sustainable. Again, this, if you will, continuum of time, particularly for major investment. The business climate has to suggest, and this is one that I will point specifically to, that there is an adaptive, proven integration and support of business. If that's not there, more so today than ever before, companies are very wary. They're very cautionary about that. It's something that in some ways they can't control. But if there's predictability based on proven execution over time, that gives them a level of assurance and that lowers the risk as it relates to business climate. Health, safety, and environmental is certainly critical, not only to their operations and being in an environment that supports that, but also for their employees and, in general, the link to quality of life, which is the next bullet. I make a note about quality of life in that it's interesting. When you start introducing these major facilities, you generally will see somewhere between 10, maybe 15% of the workforce there are redeployed, high-performing, highly educated technical people coming to those sites. They typically have spouses with them who are highly educated and have a great demand and also have a great or wider, if you will, appreciation for a variety of things that they'd like to do separate and apart of life. The Twin Cities is a great example of superior quality of life because of all the indices, education, performing arts, professional sports, so on and so forth, that stack up very nicely in that regard. The infrastructure needs to be there, utility technology. The potential for growth and the support of growth is absolutely paramount. Again, the more significant the capital investment and the positioning for these companies and portfolio, the more emphasis on is there a real potential for growth, not only to expand the site and attract the workforce and continuous operations, but is it an environment that's proven that is going to be supportive of that over time? And then land and buildings availability, that speed to market. It's always nice to have a shovel-ready site or to have prepared facilities that you can adapt to. That sometimes takes between 2 to 2.5 years out of the equation in getting up and actually producing a product or a service. And then the cost of doing business. All of these element costs between labor, facility, transportation, and in particular taxes, and those are four that really come to the top of the list for corporations, are all critical to understand what those costs are and how much that drains, if you will, the top line performance or drains their bottom line consistency. So in order to look at those typically are the three big blocks for companies as they look at location decisions. Basically, the location analysis takes on a qualitative and quantitative basis. On the qualitative, it's really the big picture. Does this really fit? Does it feel right to be where we are? Is it a balanced solution? Image is often a case, the perception of where they are and what they're doing. Attract and retain, back to image and perception and an alignment with businesses. If you think of a couple of recent cases, Boeing's decision to move to Chicago, everyone perceived that as a headquarter move. In fact, what it was the intellectual capital at a very high level to integrate with their key business partners, 350 or 500 people, actually made the move. But that was a strategic set to be more closely aligned with their particular business partners, being the aviation. It was more central to the United States for accessibility and interaction between them. And then more recently, when looking at, so in part that's a qualitative, but it's also a quantitative basis. But it's a perception, it's an integration to their partners, very, very important. These qualitative fits the core values. Companies have focused on core values, and they work hard at maintaining those. They want to be an environment that supports that and aligns with it. Innovative setting. Any company who wants to be in a setting that isn't innovative is not going to be here very long, so obviously that's key. And looking for communities in areas that are best in class across a wide range of criteria. The quantitative or the number side of it is it's fiscally and financially sound. not only the decision to be where they are, but the environment in which they are. Now, many states are struggling. Many countries are struggling right now with deficits and concerns, and that's clearly the near-term situation. But they also look at historical base and understand that are and is it proven that these communities in these areas have a sustained good practice in balancing the budgets and are fiscally responsible. Labor is absolutely critical. Despite popular opinion, nothing happens unless you have people doing it and making it happen. So that's critical and central. The facilities and the right type of facilities at cost. Pro-business. If these communities are not pro-business, more so than ever, companies are very, very wary of being in those environments. Now, there may be aspects that would indicate they're more pro-business and others that they're not. The companies are going to weigh those and determine ultimately how that's going to impact their ability from a regulatory standpoint and from a financial operating standpoint. Adaptability, flexibility, and longevity. I've spoken to those, but those are key indices about how companies decide, is this the right place to invest and why? And a competitive advantage. What is it about this place versus elsewhere that gives us a competitive advantage? The combination of these, understand the fit for community resources and how they'll be applied, really sets up the qualitative and quantitative basis. Then they get into the refined risk analysis, which typically is at least 50% financial. They're going to look at every aspect of operations, how it impacts their NPV, the P&L, the investment side. And the other side typically is dealing with things such as risk, the time and order it takes to do it, the implementation, some of the hurdles that they're going to face. They then narrow the choices and work through what we call critical financial discriminators. And I didn't want to bore you with the detail in that, but it does get very intense because they go into sub-aspects. When you look at labor, there are many aspects of labor, and they'll understand and analyze those, and they'll weight those accordingly. Now getting a little more driven down into the aspect of cash and taxes. Cash is king. It really is in all aspects. During tough economic times, added importance is placed on companies with proven and consistent cash flows and high dividend yields to offset equity risk. So credit ratings, ability to raise capital, both short-term and long-term, at reasonable rates are a fundamental indice from a financial standpoint for companies to thrive. What some people may not have realized when the height or the beginning of the major crisis, 2008, I believe, many companies that had AAA credit ratings, they still borrow short-term money in order to pay for ongoing operations. And what happened in that particular cycle is companies, banks, began to pull back on that credit, and companies were really challenged to come up with those funds, things that pay basic lined items such as payrolls. So it's surprising if you don't realize that, the dynamic of how critical that period was. And in doing so, companies who didn't have positive cash flows or didn't have the wherewithal with reserves to make that up were really in a critical crunch. Financial flexibility really then demonstrates reinvestment of capital. That's critical for companies, pursuing M&As, the R&D aspect. I know January 5th, if I recall, Wall Street Journal had a very positive article and a number of announcements, including companies such as 3M, here in reaching or going back to traditional levels of investment in R&D. I think the number was between $1 billion, which was where they were settled the year before, and indicating they're going back up to $1.5 billion. Well, that's a very significant indicator of a more positive trend, but very important for companies to compete and be successful. Increased returns to shareholders is critical for them, funding employee benefits, creating jobs. All of these go in tow with cash. From the standpoint of taxes, though, and the draw on cash and the drawdown, it's a necessary part, but there is a wide range when you start looking across the United States, and if you think about it globally, there are places that are much more competitive from a tax perspective than others. So federal, I could say international, government, federal, state, local, corporate income tax in particular, and then these range of taxes, capital, sales, property, miscellaneous, and personal income. I will tell you that in smaller companies, which in many respects, as the recovery continues, are going to be looking to shift and expand and look for other opportunities. I don't have to look any further, and I have evidence already, and even in our company at H&A, we're proposing support services for companies coming out of California. They just cannot survive in that environment any longer. So they're coming into these places and they're saying, well, this is super critical for me to be able to manage my bottom line while at the same time trying to grow up my top line. And the analogy I often use, it's like the alligator jaws. If your bottom line starts to approach your top line, the closer it gets, it's closer to death. And so the wider that margin is, the more assurance you have, if you will, of success and longevity. Personal income tax, I might add, at the higher threshold of executive level, comes into play as well. I mean, they're making some significant money in some cases, or at least they're perceived to making significant money. And personal income tax is very much a key issue for them. Well, let's look at impact, the variability by state and country and by industry. And it's very wide. So from the standpoint of service, labor tax costs, manufacturing, capital equipment taxes, and such, the decision matrix these companies look at particularly touch on these four areas: taxes, labor, facilities, and transportation. I make a note about taxes in this case, and again, this is a global indice and range. This isn't necessarily Minnesota, and this is necessarily the United States. But there is, in this perception, this ability for healthy cash flows to survive and generate and have flexibility. Taxes is one of those things that draws down on that capability. And so companies continuously look at it. Even though it may not be the highest cost center for them, it's a cost center that they have to have predictability on. And it does weigh very heavily in their decisions of where they're going to go and what they're going to invest. So let's talk a little bit about the legislation and programs and where companies are as opposed to state governments and regions. From the companies, they are adjusting their game plan to meet the new opportunities going forward. And I put up the big five: CEOs, CFOs, of course, chief operating officers, chief intellectual officers, and chief technical officers. These five individuals and companies really set the tone. They are really the audience for the decision. Their board of directors, of course, are there with them. But they are the ones who are really looking hard at these indices. Top line growth and business alignment is super critical to them. Bottom line stabilization and reduction is a critical factor. So again, my analogy of the alligator jaws. Predictable cash flows. They have to have an environment where predictable cash flows, back to the earlier point about cash, is key. And again, risk management, the whole aspect of looking at this from a risk perspective. Positioning for economic recovery is poised to invest capital. I mentioned earlier the financial industries are in position now. They do have money more readily available, and companies have been frugal, so they are positioned to invest. Increased workforce levels, they're in a position, and that January 5th article in the Wall Street Journal did indicate companies like Cummings and others were out there saying, we're going to hire 2,500 jobs here, we're going to do this in relationship to employment levels. And they're looking for the best competition. They want to beat the competition at their game. Neighboring states are adjusting their game plan as well, so they're building new foundations and sustainable growth. And meaning that, they have really shifted, particularly in the last 10 years, in doing that. The states, not surprisingly, that have made reform part of their agenda are now seeing the fruits of that effort by attracting and having major companies invest. I go back to the Boeing example. I don't mean to pick on them, but it's clear and it's more readily evident that when they were looking at expanding and making a $700 million investment, that potentially could be in the state of Washington, part of the hang-up with that was the labor environment. They had just come out of this major strike, and South Carolina was there and positioned, and through collaboration with their unions, downvoted the union, and that was the trigger point that ultimately brought, I forget the number of jobs, but it brought the $700 million to South Carolina for the new engine plant. Now, this is a 50-year opportunity that they grasped because South Carolina and their ability to manipulate and show flexibility and adjust won the day. I don't know all the indices associated with that particular decision, but it's graphic that that can be a significant deal breaker between one state and another. Economic development strategies and alignment is super critical, and that's one example. And what they're doing in that is forging relationships. They have good community and business interaction. I will tell you from a consulting standpoint as well as on the corporate standpoint, when you have environments that there's close working relationships between the key businesses in the state in which they're situated or the county or the city and government, the last and most important point that companies coming into a community stop and ask is their peer companies. They will listen to government. They will listen to economic development. They'll even listen to their consultant sometimes. But the person that they listen hardest to and longest is the peer company. And they'll say, what is this business environment like? How has it been running your business here? What are the challenges that you face? How successful have you been in forging a partnership and dialogue? And that particular meeting is critical to the success of sometimes winning that business to come. Removing risks, so reform and predictability is critical for that. Human capital, retain and attract, is absolutely important. And I will reference and go back to what I think was an outstanding report in the Minnesota Millennium 2009 report, in particular talking about the aging population and the ability to then attract business and revitalize, if you will, the new wave of employment. That's a super important critical factor. Again, long-term commitments or mid-range commitments, even at a 10-year level, companies want to know that they can attract and retain talent. The infrastructure needs to be there, so aligning specific design outcomes in terms of infrastructure, whether it's technology, whether it's transport, whether it's new ways of working, are critical for job growth. Financial capital and incentives are closing financial gaps, if you will, on deals. Now, I know there's often a big debate about incentives and how important incentives are. They really are designed, and companies look at them in this respect. They're front-end assistance in reducing startup costs, particularly in year one, and typically for a period of time between year one and year five of startup operations. And it's often, at the end of the day, if everything else is equal, they are the tiebreaker that gets companies to one place versus another. And you'll see in my last comment, and you already have it on your slide, wider range of options exist today than 10 years ago. The competition has grown up. There are many other places that are competing in many, many ways with Minnesota in particular and a number of other states, and they meet and beat a lot of the criteria. So you have to sit for a moment and recognize that that competition is clearly out there, and they're doing all of these things. Legislative reform, lower cost of doing business is a cornerstone. I touched on that throughout my presentation, and I'm reemphasizing it here because it's true. It's how these top five individuals think. It's what they're oriented to. Focus on core business and retain and grow. You in here in Minnesota in particular have this wonderful range of global companies, mid-range and small companies. But in order to focus on those core businesses, the fundamental of good economic development is to retain and grow those businesses. Focus on new business and relocation and expansions are obviously the war that is currently being waged and will continue to be waged. So your neighboring states, in part, are your competition. a lot of that interaction, more so of that, will be coming from neighboring states and regions because they want to be, let's say, in the upper Midwest, and not necessarily international coming in. But nevertheless, that is where the competition is coming from. Focus on diverse business mix, both large and small. The Twin Cities, in particular, has a wonderful mix of businesses. But to nurture and keep those vibrant and moving forward is to suggest that you need to engage them, you need to work towards reforms that are going to facilitate their desire to continue to invest in those operations. And be flexible and adaptive. Back to my example in South Carolina, those are differentiators that really, at the end of the day, talk about range of options that exist for companies and why they want to focus or would focus on Minnesota. Comparisons on the value chain, if you will, favorably, and there's a little longer list, but I chose to just talk to these particular points. Having lived here for 12 years, I can attest personally, quality of life is outstanding. Quality of labor is very high, very excellent range of skills, very strong traditional work ethic that exists. These are dynamics that are very important to companies. High education, quality, and attainment. We go into a community and ask, what's the graduation rate in high school? What's the college graduation rate? What's the retention of these individuals into that state? What are the demographics? Those are all important indices of continuation. If you have folks who are highly educated but they can't find work because the investments aren't being made, they're not going to stay around very long. And not only that, they're going to go not only to the neighboring states, they're also going to go international. They're actually going to leave. Another interesting observation is the education that we're providing for international folks coming here, and then they're leaving and going back. The question of retaining those individuals and making it an environment that says, I can take this technology ability or my engineering degree, and I don't have to go back to India to apply it. I can do it in Mankato, or I can do it in the Twin City immediate region. A diverse mix of business segments, as I mentioned before, and the global headquarters that reside here. A geographic orientation, this is an excellent place in order to get east, south, west, sometimes north, maybe in June and July. And the international airport and the investment in that is a huge issue for growth. Now, less favorable, because there's always two sides to the equation. Cost of labor, typically to other areas, is relatively high. The cost of doing business, taxes in particular, corporate and personal. This report, again, former Governor Pawlenty's Minnesota Millennium Tax Reform Commission 2009 report, really does set the tone in many respects for what I refer to as the perception. And companies that are coming, again, they're going to get fixated down in the perception about whether this is a state, these are the communities that are going to be flexible and show reform in a way that is meaningful over time. It's not a stop point in time, but it's an extension, has a continuum to it. Economic development, tools that are there in place, incentives are important. I'd say in terms of Minnesota's incentives, and I won't get into those, that isn't really an intent today, but relative to your competition and to that point earlier about if all things are equal and these are the ones that are deal breakers, you're probably not going to win some of those deal breakers. They're just not as competitive, and they're not positioned in a way that will convince companies to come. I put a line, United Regional Economic Alliance. What I mean by that is, and there are some indicators near term that this is changing around, particularly between St. Paul and Minneapolis. But many regions have recognized the importance of creating alliances with multiple counties. And I'm not speaking to the Met Council in that aspect. I'm talking about purely an economic development perspective. They are aligned in a way that says it's beneficial to us all, even though my particular city or my county didn't win that big deal. But the true economic impact of direct, indirect, and induced value, we will benefit. And so we need to be united about coaxing and bringing that kind of perspective to the companies that are coming. Whereas in the past, there really was some separation and there was some divide. If it's out in Mankato or if it's in Duluth or it's somewhere else in the state, it pretty much stands on its own, but it will compete against those other metro areas. But right here in this dynamic, very rich center of commerce, there really wasn't that continuity. The chambers are beginning to work, as I've noted, towards that end. But you go to a number of other areas in the country, and they have dynamic alliances that include 10, 15, 20 counties. And in where I happen to reside right now, in North Carolina and South Carolina, neighboring counties in South Carolina recognize the vibrance, as does Charlotte region, in having what they call Regional Charlotte Alliance. And so they will promote business and show them to go to these counties in South Carolina, but guess what? Some and a lot of those people end up living in Charlotte region and working in South Carolina. So there is a benefit in this type of approach. A divided front, the legislative, urban, suburban, and rural. I know you know this. I'm not speak to that, but it is a dynamic that sometimes gets in the way of reform, and it's something just to be recognized and understand going forward. So from a comparative perspective, there are other indices I chose to use back to the point of the leaders who are ultimately making these decisions, a comparison of Minnesota using the CEO survey ratings best and worst out of May, June 2010 Chief Executive Magazine. With this criteria, they really chose three leading ones: taxation and regulation, quality of workforce, and living environment. They had a wide bandwidth of levels of companies participating, 651. And with that, they had these rankings that came out. And interestingly, in Texas, not surprising, Texas, North Carolina, Tennessee, Virginia, and Nevada, in particular, Virginia is one that I mentioned, really worked hard at reform in the last 5 years or so to position themselves better to be more effective in winning those jobs. A number of these in Nevada, I think, as well. So it's not surprising, based on the business climate that they've created, that these are winning out and have this perception. On the low end, and emphasis on California, we read about that all the time. I mean, they're their own worst enemy. Companies, unless they absolutely have to pick that poison, I don't think are going to want to be in California. And there are many who would love not to be there if they could. There are others that need to be because of the nature of the business. Minnesota in this particular ranking came in 31st. The CEO attributes, work ethic, lower tax rates, were called out specifically in this survey. The attitude towards business in general, living environment, the real estate cost, and education. So at the end of the day, the ratings that this report showed, taxation and regulation was a C- for Minnesota. Quality workforce, not surprising, AA- and living environment, B. Well, what does this say? To me, this says that, in fact, the decision makers, this is just a sample. There are thousands and thousands of businesses. But it then gets back to this point of who are you really, who is your audience? And it is this leading entity at the top of these companies and their board of directors that are driving, again, this whole aspect of financial performance, business climate, and a place we can grow and nurture. So with that, I would just close with saying thank you very much for this opportunity to address Madam Chair, the Committee on Global and Local Competition, which, as I mentioned, is fierce and is only going to get tougher. So standing still is a dangerous proposition. Moving forward and being innovative and showing effort to reform will be a competitive advantage. To level the playing field through effective tax reform will make CEOs, both U.S. and global, stand up and take notice. Or there is that risk of falling further behind, quite honestly. Promoting a better business climate will send a strong message to key decision makers that Minnesota is a player on the global scale and is prepared to create a business platform that companies can rely on to grow their business. This is a mainstay. Building partnerships with existing businesses as they are your best ally in attracting new business. I made that point earlier. I'd like to reemphasize it. And revisit and seriously consider acting on a number of the recommendations that are in this report that other states, in part, have enacted and would put Minnesota, both in attracting small and larger businesses and their expansion, put Minnesota in a better light. So with those comments, I thank you very much.
Mr. Beatty, thank you so much. As I said to you earlier in my office, it can be a luxury to serve in the Minnesota Senate when folks will come and teach us what we need to know. It's like being in college again, and I appreciate that so much. I wanted to ask you if you could just expand a little on one of your slides, if you would. It was the one that says analysis, location, selection. The third column, you've said refine risk analysis. So corporations make a qualitative analysis, a quantitative analysis, and then they refine the risk analysis. And I wanted to ask you about that third one. How in-depth do they go, generally speaking? And, you know, those choices, you talked about sub-aspects. Do they actually run profit and loss statements for different states or different locations to see how they come out? Will you just talk a little bit about that, if you would?
Sure. Madam Chair and committee, yes, the companies, in particular in the capital investment side, whether it's land, buildings, and the equipment, really run rigorous NPVs and P&Ls to understand the investment side and as well the supporting, if you will, or lack thereof of supporting aspects. So to the point of incentives and front-end investment and offsetting those costs, they certainly improve the net present value of those investments and the impact on P&L. They will go to great lengths to understand with sub-factors within each one of these indices. So if you go back to facilities, and they'll look at, as an example, the ability for that facility to not only meet their immediate needs but grow. And an example of financial hardship or their inability to be effective, they will say, for instance, water is a critical factor to whether or not we can sustain operations. So in relationship to the facility and where it is to quality water, whether the community really has made that investment or is in a position to make that investment to support that type of operation. They will take, and in this, and this is where the matrices of weighted factors in H&A, we spend a great deal of time with our clients working through these matrices, want to remove the subjective aspect of it and really look at it from purely what the numbers tell them. So in each analysis, there is a critical or a set of critical subfactors, the discriminators, that are applied and weights put to those that then give some indication of whether or not this is meeting the criteria thereafter or not and why. And this is hotly debated because then the aspect of risk that they're willing to take on the basis that this will be prove out to be successful going forward takes shape. And once these organizations, the larger the company, there are more people obviously participating. The smaller it typically is just a select few. The more time they take to look at this and work through it, you find out that, in fact, if the analysis is done correctly, it's clear which sites are better served to meet the business requirement and the actual facility requirement than not. So in looking at weighting these, in some cases, image and perception, for instance, just on the qualitative side, will get a weight, and some companies do not want to perceive this glorified look. They want to, they will weight against that and say, we're not going to build this cathedral of operations. That's not where we want the perception to be. And the available resources or the available facilities to us would suggest we're going to have to build something. Nothing's adaptive for our needs. What are we going to do about that perception of us spending money on glorified facilities as opposed to products and services or R&D or the quality of the product we're producing? So it's a very detailed analysis. I'm happy to share with you and the committee examples of that. I didn't bring one or have it in a slide. I did a few weeks ago in another presentation. But it's an interesting example to look at some of these matrices because they're quite detailed. And at the end of the day, they should bring out the best decisions based on a very rigorous set of weights and criteria.
Thank you. And when they do that, then do they also, you talked about the sustainability, the 20, 30, 40 years out, do they run them that far out so that they can then predict the impact to the investment?
Typically, they will have aspects of these analyses that on certain indicators, such as, let's say, pro-business, they'll look at a historical track record and weigh that against what they perceive will be that track record going forward. And in these larger settings, there's absolute set criteria they must have. Again, to an industrial manufacturing setting, they absolutely have to have Votech nearby. They absolutely have to have a university or educational forum that's going to partner on a number of opportunities for that. They have to have a certain amount of demographics working for them. 30 years ago, companies would think nothing of setting a pretty significant operation in 20, 25,000 employee-based, and maybe the county or surrounding would be 200,000. Today, that was perceived as a high risk. And they would want to be in a community that was no less than 250 to 500,000 people to ensure that they're going to have a rich draw of quality talent. So in each one of these settings, they are looking, particularly the higher the investment and the more strategic the investment to their business and core business or emerging business, the longer out they look. And so those types of balancing factors definitely are put into their thinking.
Thank you. Senator Michelle.
Thank you, Chair Ortman, and thank you, Mr. Hickey. Not Mr. Hickey? Oh, Mr. Beatty. Thank you. We're trying to bridge the suburban and urban divide that you talked about. Thank you, Senator Pogermiller. Mr. Beatty, I want to start again by thanking the Chair. And I just appreciate the perspective that this can bring to the rest of the work that we need to do this session. I read a couple weeks ago a number that, you know, it's one of those huge numbers that is hard for us to get our hands around. $2 trillion. The number was $2 trillion, and that was the amount of cash that United States non-financial companies have on their books, parked, waiting, trying to get through a recession. So I see in that $2 trillion, we've begun this discussion in the Senate Jobs Committee, some of that money could be the seeds of economic recovery here in Minnesota. So what can we do? That's why I think this presentation is so helpful. What can we do to make it easier for those companies, those firms, those individuals, those risk takers to choose Minnesota? That's where I want to take a risk now. I think that's a real helpful perspective. The other thing I wanted to suggest and maybe have you comment on is if we are, and I guess we're all hoping, if we are on the edge of a recovery and those firms are going to start making decisions, that there's a particular importance with this the next 5 months here. The decisions that we make in this budget cycle, in this legislative session with a new governor in the corner office, will really make a big imprint on whatever brand Minnesota has. I believe we have a high-cost, high-tax brand right now, and that hurts. That hurts some of these decisions that you've talked about today. So I really think that this is a kind of a useful lens for us to use going forward, I hope this isn't the only time we have a chance to think about it in these terms, Madam Chair. And so I guess, Mr. Beatty, my question to you is, if you agree with, I guess, some of those fundamentals that I was commenting on, and the importance of, just as we're coming out of a near depression, the importance of the next couple months for Minnesota as a state.
Mr. Beatty.
Madam Chair, Senator, I would agree wholeheartedly that, as I've stated earlier, and it's been reported that companies, again, through this optimization and consolidation and conservative view of the profits that they have made in difficult times, have been putting those funds in reserve, waiting for opportunity. They also, though, have not lost sight of operations, and they look very closely at where and how that is going to be best deployed. So they've had some time to think about it, and they, back to an earlier slide about strategizing, moving from a strategic perspective to a tactical perspective, they're poised to do this. And where that is going to depend very much on what are the needs of the particular business that they're after. If it's more of a startup kind of operation, they're going to look probably hard at early on and assistance in the near term. But again, to the basic fundamentals that assure them that it can grow this business over time. No one wants to start something up just to fail. They really do want and need to be successful in order to compete and win. And so to that end, they're looking for partnerships and they're looking for environments that are going to be pro-business. That doesn't mean they're looking for handouts per se in all places. And in many cases, they're looking for unique or flexible or creative things that they need, particularly from their perspective, in support of doing that. So it does vary based on the business. It does vary based on the industry. But nevertheless, and to really my closing comments, and I think to your point, it's important to think about going forward, but not lose perspective on what's occurred in the past. Meaning that if you haven't had the success you had desired, there's got to be a reason for it. And on the basis of that self-analysis, look to those particular states, and for that matter, even some countries that have positioned themselves very well to take advantage of that. Now, I'll use an example. It happens to be an international example of a competition that not everyone may be obviously aware of today, but the competition of call center and support centers that are occurring between India and the Philippines. And in fact, one would think on top, India is winning that hands down. But in fact, they're not. The Philippines are, and for varying reasons. But they've taken advantage and leveraged a particular aspect that in the Filipino community, they have a little better framework in which to articulate back to the U.S. market in particular in how their dialect in speaking English is. Now, that may seem trivial, but in fact, it's a significant competitive advantage. And they're leveraging it. They're taking full advantage. So they have a number of 375,000 people employed in the Philippines, I think Wall Street Journal reported a few weeks ago, that are able to do that. They're also going to support and take advantage of that in terms of the facilities and the support those businesses can have to take advantage of that. So there are a number of examples, but I think in the end, in order to look at competing is to take a hard look at the past, what hasn't worked, and work hard to change that, and recognize who else, through benchmarking, has been doing and making these reforms, and they're succeeding. They're attracting it. There are a lot of good things that are working here, but then there are a lot of other things that, in the end, when it comes down to the decision-making, they're going to be cautionary about wanting to make those kinds of investments.
Thank you, Mr. Beatty. Hopefully we have time for one more question from Senator Howe.
Mr. Chair, or
Senator
Madam Chair.
Bach. Senator Howe.
Mr. Beatty, I just wanted to ask you about, I'm sure the companies don't do 31 in-depth analysis, you know, and we're ranked 31. So first we need to get on that radar screen, and it looks like we're doing a pretty good job with quality of workforce, and that labor is 40% to 85% on the decision matrix, but I don't know if that's quality of the labor or the cost of the labor. And so, you know, in another life, I used to be the chairman of the Sears Dealer Store Owners Association. We had owners in all 50 states and in Puerto Rico, and we had over 700 owners, and we did $1.5 billion in sales. We had a period of record growth, record profits, but we still, you know, in California, you couldn't make money because of the energy costs. That was the driver there. And in New York, it was the rental space. I mean, the space to have a place. And so I'm just wondering what we can do as a legislative body to get ourselves on that radar screen. What should we focus on? And I'm not sure how we get there if we're looking at industrial jobs, and you know, there's so many different factors. But what should we be focusing on? Obviously, we don't want to lose the quality of our workforce, and we see taxes here are 12% to 15%. And we had a little discussion earlier about, well, there, you know, our corporate tax rate is 9.8, but the effective may be 3.1. But if we're not on the radar screen, they're not going to find out that after all the tax exemptions or refunds that they can get their corporate tax down to that rate. So how do we get up to that radar screen? And would it be better for us not to have all these behind or incentives and have just a lower corporate tax rate or no corporate tax rate when it comes to taxes?
Mr. Beatty.
Madam Chair, Senator, I think communities that understand what is their strengths and their weaknesses, just to put it in real simple terms, and work from that point going forward is critical. And if you will, deciding what are the important businesses and the important opportunities that need to be focused on is one aspect. I mean, there are communities that say we're going to be biotech and we're going to be in a particular area. That's where we see the growth, and that's where we're going to put our emphasis. But at the same time, you have to consider what is your base and what makes you successful today. So the existing businesses that are here and what they're attempting to do, aligning with those businesses and understanding those needs. I think in any respect, and not to get to the specifics about the actual indice or detail of tax reform, but clearly businesses view that, and those numbers that I shared are global numbers, and they range greatly, examples you shared. And there are other aspects, such as utility costs in one place versus another, and they bounce around considerably. But I think at the end of the day, if government is working with businesses to create a more competitive business environment based on some of these fundamental essentials that the companies need, they're better positioned to not only maintain the core that they have, which is fundamental, but also grow that core as well as attract new business. So the aspect of reform, again, to the point of continue to do what you've always done, is probably not going to be a competitive advantage for you going forward. Looking for ways to adjust and maintain and also benchmark what's been successful elsewhere would be, in my view, a smart way of at least assessment and then determining through prioritization what are going to be effective. Clearly, decision makers, one survey doesn't make it true, but it would point that business climate and the ability to lower operating costs and create a competitive business environment from a cost standpoint alone is a critical factor for the decision makers that are deciding where they want to site a particular business and why. If you have to be there, you're going to try to mitigate it at all costs, and then you go. But if you have choices, and these companies have a lot more choices today than they had 20 or 30 years ago, both globally and throughout the United States, They're going to be very, very tough about the longevity and the success that business has based on the business environment and the cost of doing business. Hope that answered your question, or at least alluded to it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Beatty. We're going to have to be very brief here, Senator Bach, and then Senator Senjum, and then we'll have to end the hearing. It is 12 after 10, so I'll ask you both to be as brief as possible. Thank you, Senator Bach.
Mr. Beatty, I agree that any time you're surveying anybody, I guess, perceptions, people have certain perceptions, and certainly CEOs of these 651 CEOs had some perceptions of Minnesota as a place to do business. But I appreciate your comment that one survey does not make a trend, because I'm looking at one that was done by MarketWatch.com actually in December, and it lists the 10 best cities to do business in. And they, you know, they have the same kind of a similar number of criteria. Minneapolis comes in fifth. That's I think we all should be proud of that. But I think what's kind of interesting about that is of the top 10 cities that they list, only one is in a state that this data of yours shows is in the top five, Richmond, Virginia. All the other nine are in other states that aren't in the top five. And matter of fact, New York is listed, I believe, as eighth on here, as one of the eighth best city to do business, and this study has New York as one of the worst five states to do business in. So I think perceptions are important, and certainly there's a perception, and certainly the governor of Wisconsin is trying to show us that now, that our doors are open for business. I think many of you remember the same kind of governor's battle here when Rudy Perpich and the governor of South Dakota went at it like that for years. South Dakota still doesn't have a Fortune 500 company, but Wisconsin doesn't have any great environment to sell. I mean, their personal income tax rates are higher than Minnesota's when you consider the generous credits and deductions that Minnesota has. Minnesota has actually a net effective corporate rate that's pretty competitive at 3.1%. I don't know that Wisconsin can beat us there.
Excuse me, Senator Bach, is this a question? Because we are after the hour here, and I want to be respectful of our witness and the
Madam
time.
Madam Chair, this is an important discussion because perceptions are important. And then my final point is, Mr. Beatty, how important is it that if perceptions are important among CEOs, that the governor, the chief executive of the state, portray this as a good state to do business? Certainly the governor of Wisconsin is trying to do that right now. But I'll just say this. We just came off of 8 years where we had a governor traveling all around the country demonizing this state, that it's such a terrible place to do business. Why would anybody ever come here? Well, if perceptions are real to CEOs, do you think that's problematic? And is there some advice you could give to Senator Dayton, I guess, as he kind of gets his wings as a governor? Is there a role the chief executive of the state could play to help with the perceptual or real problem that we have in the minds of these CEOs? Is it something that we could convey to Senator Dayton? Somebody in his office is probably watching. Is there something he could do to help perceptually with these CEOs?
Senator Bach, there was a lot there. And Mr. Beatty, with respect, if there's any comment you have or response to Senator Bach, if not, we know it's late in the hour, but I'm sure that it's more than just one quick answer about what Governor Dayton might be able to do to help us here. But any tip that you might offer, and we can maybe have a longer conversation later through other methods of communication, but any tip off the top of your hat for Governor Dayton?
Madam Chair and Senator, that is a lot. I don't know if I'm in the position to offer any advice to Governor-elect Dayton. I think when you go back and look at the qualitative and quantitative analysis and focus on the quantitative analysis from a business perspective, working in concert with improving against meaningful benchmarks, who's winning the business, in establishing a strategic plan that embraces change, that levels the playing field with your competition, is going to begin to win the day. There's no question that leadership needs to be employed to do that. In the states that have made that change, they've had that leadership, and they've also had that bipartisan activity that sees those changes put into place. But again, recognizing it as a global competition and regional competition is understanding why your competition is winning out and you're not. I'm not saying that particularly as it relates to Minnesota not winning some businesses, but near-term evidence that there are other states that are doing probably a little bit better in that area. So with that, thank you.
Thank you. Senator Sundin, did you have a question for the witness?
Just a brief one, and the answer can be somewhat brief. I'm just going to assume that you've seen a lot of state economic development laboratories across the country in the form of economic development departments and so on and so forth. And they probably all vary a little bit in terms of, if you will, how good they are. So my question is, does a state even, let's just start off from scratch, does a state even need an economic development department? And then if the answer is yes, and I presume it is, what kind of a department should we be looking for? And what should be their strengths? What should be their vision, their mission, and so on and so forth? Should it be number crunching, or should it be a salesmanship, or both? And you don't need to name states, but have you got any examples of what you would regard as a great economic development state from the standpoint of a economic development department?
Mr. Beatty?
Madam Chair, Senator, the short of it is you need to have a voice that's going to interact with folks such as myself who in our firm who bring clients to particular communities and can frame and help address what that community can do in support of this business opportunity. Generally, they're very high professionals, and they understand that. But to enlist them and give them tools in order to be effective is, again, back to an earlier comment about benchmarking what are the most effective economic development organizations and why. Unity in the community, and back to the earlier example about collaboration and regional alliances, is one example of presenting a united front. That's a strength statement. And so because of nature of time and where we are, it's an interesting discussion, but I would say that, again, benchmarking some of those better practices and identifying what it is that those particular communities are doing and winning is something to then reevaluate. All companies are constantly benchmarking. I'm sure government entities are doing the same, and economic development are doing the same. So that would be my short answer to that question.
Thank you. Mr. Beatty, it's been wonderful having you today. We've learned a lot, and you've also provoked many questions on the part of the committee, and we'll be following up. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
This hearing is adjourned.